Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Lila will be joining us pretty soon. And we're going to do some, talk about a few things tonight. I wanted everybody to know that my, I wanted to announce tonight that my book, Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril, is available. You can get it on Amazon right now. And once you order, it takes about 7 days to get your book from them. So reorder now. If you can just go up to Amazon.com and check out Naked at the Mic. Just say Naked at the Mic. We'll get you right there. And it's the Naked at the Mic, Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And Lila is here with us.
Yes, I am. Good
and
evening, folks.
And I give all credit to Lila. The book is dedicated to Lila, actually. But
as it should be.
As it should be. And it's also
actually
talks
I'm
about
very flattered.
Lila gave me the title. She actually came up with the title in one of her moments of intuitive genius.
Clarity. Well, a moment of clarity amongst
yeah.
time of great
so,
fog.
So if the book doesn't sell as well, then I could blame it on the title.
You could blame it. Gee, thanks, Leo.
Yeah. So anyway, somebody to blame it on besides myself.
Oh well.
Yeah.
Shared pain.
Oh,
but well.
I thought this was an interesting article. I thought we should read tonight. It's on that H1N1 virus. But it turns out that vaccines were all contaminated.
Some of them were a particular batch. I can read that.
It's important to read that one because anybody who happened to get the flu shot should know that they might.
Yeah, unless you move the light over, Leo, I cannot see it. Okay. This is rotavirus vaccine contaminated. Federal health officials recommended Monday that doctors suspend using Rotarex, one of two vaccines licensed in the United States against rotavirus, saying the vaccine is contaminated with materials from a pig virus. Rotarex, made by GlaxoSmithKline, was approved by the FDA in 2008. The contaminated material is DNA from porcine circovirus, one, a virus from pigs that is not known to cause disease in humans and animals, Hamburg said. About 1 million children in the United States, about 30 million worldwide, have gotten Rotarex vaccine, she said. Rotavirus disease kills more than 500,000 infants around the world each year, primarily in low- and middle-income countries, she said. Before rotavirus vaccine became available, the disease was blamed for more than 50,000 hospitalizations and several dozen deaths per year in the United States, she said. The FDA learned about the contamination after an academic research team using a novel technique to look for viruses in a range of vaccines found the material in GlaxoSmithKline product and told the company, Hamburg said. The drug maker confirmed its presence in both the cell banks and the seed from which the vaccine is derived, suggesting the presence from the early stages of vaccine development, she said. The FDA then confirmed the drug maker's findings. GlaxoSmithKline emphasized Monday that the pig virus is not known to cause the illness in humans, saying it's found in everyday meat products and is frequently eaten with no resulting disease or illness. In the next 4 to 6 weeks, the drug agency will convene an advisory committee to make recommendations and seek input in the use of new techniques for identifying viruses and vaccine, Hamburg said. So that's something to think about. So I guess you can't be too careful in what you eat or what injections you get.
Oh, you know, I forgot to tell the people what we have for our interview tonight. We have an interview with
it's Larry Dorman,
Public
Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Union, and he's going to give us a little insight on the health bill, and he knows a lot more than we do. But he doesn't know everything, folks. You have to realize that bill is huge. and he can just speak to some of the parts that he's aware of. So you can't, and he's not to blame for the bad things in the bill either.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But he does a good job talking about it, and he enlightens us a little bit. I mean, both Leo and I, if it's okay if I say this, Leo, we're not thrilled with the health care bill, but we both, at least I'll say for myself, I'm glad we got a health care foot in the door. So that perhaps, perhaps Americans who are not covered can get some health care. You know, I just don't think it's right that so many people have to suffer without health care or illness, or they have a catastrophic illness and their families are wiped out, or they're sick and they can't get coverage even though they have health care. That doesn't seem right. Or they're denied a treatment.
Or their health care is canceled because
they're too sick.
They're too sick. So, I don't know what's going to come of it. We talk about it on the, we talked a great deal about it on the interview tonight with Larry. So, and that's about as far as we still can go.
Yeah, we really don't know very much more about it. Nobody else seems to know very much more about it either. So, God, I just hope it doesn't have any horrid surprises in it that'll upset everybody.
Yeah. You didn't read this.
I can't read it. So
it's
the
so
print
small.
Is. Sometimes, yeah. Folks, the print on these articles is just so small.
A European printout. And, wait a second here.
It's right on the bottom.
Well, it's
From David Icke.
But DavidIcke.com, but it's an open letter from Sinead O'Connor regarding the crimes and cover-up of the Catholic Church. Now, as you know, Sinead was famous for ripping up a picture.
Didn't she do something?
Saturday Night Live, yeah. She tore up a picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live. And
that was a few years ago, right?
No, I think it was about 10 years ago.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah. Maybe even longer. And, but she's no lover of the Pope, that's for sure, and neither am I. And, but this thing is, she's being Irish, and being,
probably brought up a Catholic.
A very strong advocate for Irish rights and so on. Sinead O'Connor, who's a wonderful singer as well, wrote this open letter to the Pope. It says, an open letter from Sinead O'Connor regarding the crimes and cover-up of the Catholic Church. This was dated yesterday, March 23rd, 2010. And it says, a little-known fact is that until 2001, there were explicit rules in place issued by the Vatican to every bishop in the world on how to deal with allegations of abuse. These rules included a vow of the utmost secrecy under threat of excommunication to be sworn by clergy receiving complaints and sworn by victims. Excuse me. The documents state these matters must be restrained by perpetual silence.
You gotta be kidding.
Yeah, that's, she quotes that too. It says, in 2000, then Cardinal Ratzinger sent, Pope now, sent another set of instructions to every bishop in the world, stating that allegations were to be dealt with exclusively by the Church and were subject to the pontifical secret, which means one risks excommunication by discussing matters of abuse outside of the Church. Yeah. I also have the text of the oath sworn by clergy and victims. The Vatican strategy, as shown in Saturday's letter from the Pope to Irish Catholics, is to sell the Irish Catholic hierarchy down the river by making it seem they are acting independently of the Vatican when they cover up abuse. Excuse me. That is a lie, and in fact, the letter is a thesis in the fine art of lying and betraying one's own people. The fact that the Irish hierarchy are allowing themselves to be sold down the river and are leaping in front of bullets for the Vatican makes me wonder if they themselves are living under abusive and bullying circumstances. It seems to me the hierarchy revere and fear the Vatican more than they fear the God they are supposed to believe in. Why are they not telling the truth, which is that they, like Nazis, were following explicit orders. That fact does not exonerate them, but is something we must all need to understand. Excuse me. I know an old man who lately has got a bit dotty. He has money, but has been caught 3 times stealing small items from his local supermarket. Last week, he was handcuffed, arrested, and spent a day and a night in jail. Meanwhile, not one member of the clergy the world over who were involved in following Vatican orders to cover up have even been questioned by the police, as any of the rest of us would be if we knew of such crimes and covered them up. Neither has the Vatican been the subject of any criminal investigation. The Pope's letter repeatedly suggests that for the healing of the victims in our nation, we should return to the Church, and claims the Church is the only avenue through that, in my opinion, is through that which we may conduct a relationship with Christ. That, in my opinion, is blasphemy. Why should we remain in or return to a relationship with an organization which has so little respect for its victims or the rest of us that they are lying to our faces and treating us like half-wits, which we are if we let them get away with it? I like Sinead O'Connor. I don't care. We are in an extremely dysfunctional relationship with an organization which is actually abusing us. 3 weeks ago, we were told by the Bishop of Ferns that it was our God-given duty to put to help church pay their legal bills and compensation to the victims. We were told it would be unchristian of us not to do so. We were told it would be in the interest of the future welfare of the children for us to cough up along with our little old ladies and gentlemen. This is abuse. All of us know someone who is or has been an abusive relationship. We would rightly advise our loved ones to get up and walk away. What victims deserve the world over is a full confession from the Vatican that they ordered the cover-up and that they are now trying to cover up the cover-up. The only way the victims or the rest of us will get that confession is by boycotting them in order to bring them to their knees and refuse to go to Mass until they fully confess. If they don't confess, they are finished. It is only a matter of time. Confession is one slim chance of survival. Excuse me. The fact is, we don't need them to get to God or to have a relationship with Jesus. We never did need them. And the beautiful position we are in now is that they need us. We should illustrate this fact, all caring Catholic people, by boycotting them until they confess and show palpable remorse and respect to God and to their victims. Sinead O'Connor, Ireland.
Good for her.
I didn't know she was a Catholic.
Oh, yeah, everybody in Ireland is brought up a Catholic. She's from Ayr.
Yeah, but she tore up the Pope's picture.
Well,
I thought she was Protestant.
No, Protestants don't care about the Pope.
I know, that's why they tear the picture up.
But no, they're not emotional like that.
She's an emotional Catholic.
Yeah.
So she's probably was molested young.
Something probably happened to her.
But
I'm pleased that she's standing up to an organization that's been corrupt like that.
Yeah. Well,
good for her. I'm sure she's sure they hate her for it.
You don't need anybody to
interpret God for you. God is always with you if you just look for him. You don't need a priest or anybody else to...
Yeah, or definitely some sex pervert. To find them for you. I mean, good God. I mean,
that's what's so sad.
I mean, strike these people down, Lord God. You know, come on. They've maligned you and maligned your...
The Catholic Church was in such trouble here in the United States. You think they would have learned a lesson? But those people are still in the church.
The people that still follow the church. It's like, why?
Well,
God,
it's in trouble over here. I don't think there's anybody except old people that go.
My brother does.
Well.
Yeah. But other people do. I mean, a lot of people
go. Not that many.
Rob does. Rob goes to... Rob's a churchgoer. I don't know why, but you know they are, and I can't. But I mean, I respect whatever they're doing. But my God, I mean, I would be the first to throw a spear at that bastard.
Why would you want to give money to
an organization that molests your kids?
Yeah.
Or even molested you. You know, it's like, oh,
and then
sorry.
Works to cover
yeah.
it up.
Yeah. Just,
you know, they don't come clean and stand
forward. We're talking 10,000 cases in the United States and at least 10,000 in Ireland now and more in all around Europe. I mean, you're talking probably hundreds of thousands of victims that of sexual abuse by Catholic priests.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, I mean, I wouldn't doubt if Ratzinger had his nose up somebody's butt, you know what I mean?
We don't know,
some kid. You know, it's really sick.
It's a sick organization.
The Catholic Church is gone, man. It's gonzo, gonzo.
They lost their credibility for me a long time ago, and
yeah.
it just put the last nail in the coffin.
And I stopped even remotely believing in that church when I was 16 years old. So it's like, you know, I knew it had nothing to do with anything worthwhile.
Anyway, and from Press TV, the U.S. may try Cindy Sheehan for anti-war campaign. U.S. authorities have arrested a number of anti-war protests, including high-profile activist Cindy Sheehan, during a demonstration in Washington, D.C. 8 peace activists were detained after laying coffins near a fence outside the White House during a Saturday rally in which thousands of anti-war protesters gathered at a park in the area to make this mark the 7th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. They were demanding the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. The protesters directed their anger at U.S. President Barack Obama and demanded action against former President George W. Bush and his vice president, Dick Cheney. Sheehan, arrested at the end of the march, had earlier said, "We did lose some momentum when Obama came into office, but now we have younger people that are very energetic. They know we can change the world." Sheehan, who had been an anti-war campaigner since she lost a son in the Iraq War, may stand trial, reports indicate. She gained repute as an activist, peace activist, in 2005 for protesting outside Bush's Texas ranch. So maybe she'll choose to stand trial to bring attention to the issue. I guess she was probably arrested at that march.
Yes, she was. This is moneymarkets.com. It's an article I think it's kind of really important to read this, man. Maybe you can help me with it. It's a little long. But this is, it's really quite frightening. Bernanke running amok. And this is by Martin Weiss, PhD. That's dated March 22nd, 2010. It says, Fed Chairman Bernanke is running amok, and for the first time since the birth of the U.S. dollar, our government is egregiously abusing its power to print money. Specifically, from September 10, 2008 to March 10th of this year, he has increased the nation's monetary base from $850 billion to $2.1 trillion, an irresponsible, irrational, and insane increase of 2.5 times in just 18 months. It is by far the greatest monetary expansion in U.S. history, and you must not underestimate its sweeping historical significance. How the Fed is trashing history and threatening our nation's future. Precisely 217 years and 50 weeks ago, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton established the dollar as an America's national currency when Congress passed the Coinage Act of 1792. Since that memorable date, the United States has suffered through one pandemic, 2 Great Depressions, 11 major wars, and 44 recessions. 4 U.S. presidents have been assassinated while in office. Hundreds of thousands of businesses have gone bankrupt. Tens of millions of Americans have lost their jobs. In the wake of these disasters, there were, to be sure, monetary and fiscal excesses. But never did the U.S. government resort to extreme abuses of its money-printing power. Never did it make that unforgivable blunder until now. Now all those years of suffering and sacrifice, all that history of leadership and discipline have been trashed, all for the sake of perpetrating America's addiction to spending, borrowing, and the wildest speculations of all times. Louder voices of protest. I'm not the only one who has shouted this warning from the rooftops. Other more prominent than I have also raised the voices in protest. Thomas Honing, president of the Financial Reserve Bank of Kansas, and a lone dissenter in last week's meeting of the Fed's Open Market Committee, is among the most prominent. He sees three possible pathways to our nation's fiscal and monetary policy. Now, path number one is monetize. The government runs massive debts and borrows it without restraint. At the same time, the Federal Reserve monetizes the debt, finances it by running the nation's printing presses. This is the path of least resistance for politicians and the greatest danger to the nation. Yet unfortunately, as evidenced by the explosion in the monetary base illustrated above, it's also the speedway down which the Fed is now racing. And that's the, they have a graph here, and it shows from 1960 to 2000, mm-hmm. actually.
The number
of dollars that were printed rose, okay? See, from 1960
yep.
to 2000. And then by 9/11/2001, there was this huge explosion, okay, of spending.
Mm-hmm.
Until now, in 2009 and 2010, it spiked way up to beyond like $2,500 billion. So that's like $2.5 trillion that they printed. They never printed more than $1 trillion at any time, all the way from 1960 up to 2000. And then after 2000, they just went crazy. In 2000, by 9/11, they borrowed ridiculous amounts of money, and that was because we're in two wars.
Yeah.
All right, and Bush was crazy, and we bailed out the banks, and I mean, it's just crazy. So
we need to get out of those wars, and we would have plenty of money.
Oh, the Fed is trashing history. Honig also said, number two, policy stalemate. As in path one, the government runs massive deficits and borrows without restraint, but the Federal Reserve refuses to finance it. Instead, the Fed lets the natural supply and demand of the debt drive interest rates higher. So the government finds it is too expensive or nearly impossible to borrow, and ultimately, Washington has no choice but to slash spending despite any near-term consequences. And this is what is happening to many governments around the world right now. Not only is Greece, but also in California, Arizona, New Jersey, Massachusetts, plus scores of other states and local governments across the USA. In the final analysis, Washington cannot avoid a similar day of reckoning. And path number three is fiscal discipline. The government takes strong, proactive steps to reduce the deficit. This is, of course, extremely tough politically in the absence of a massive fiscal and financial crisis. But unless pursued prominently or promptly and aggressively, the government winds up forced to do it anyhow, albeit the more urgency and greater trauma for the country and its people.
Mm.
And he says that when I was named president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City in 91, my 85-year-old neighbor gave me a $500,000 mark German note. He had been in Germany during its hyperinflation and told me that in 1921, the note would have bought a house. In 1923, it would not even buy a loaf of bread. And he said, I want you to have this note as a reminder. Your duty is to protect the value of the currency. That note is framed and hanging in my office.
Whoa.
He says, someone recently wrote that I evoked hyperinflation for effect. Many say it could never happen here in the U.S. To them, I ask, would anyone have believed 3 years ago that the Federal Reserve would have $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities on its books today? Not likely. So I ask your indulgence in reminding all that the unthinkable becomes possible when the economy is under severe stress. And if German hyperinflation seems an unrealistic example for the past, distant past, then let's come forward in time. Many have noted that in the 1960s, the Federal Reserve willingness to accommodate fiscal demands and help finance spending on the Great Society and the Vietnam War contributed to a period of accelerated price increases. Although the Federal Reserve was a reluctant participant, it accepted the view that monetary policy should work in the same direction as the Congress. Administrative goals now finance at least part of their spending programs. Monetary policies accommodations during the period contribute to an increase in inflation from roughly 1.5% in 65 to almost 6% in 1970. It also helped to set the stage for the great inflation of the 1970s and as inflation expectations gradually became anchored. And
So what's the answer?
David, this other guy said that David Walker, who was the former head of the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, and president of Peter G. Foundation, fears a Greek-like Armageddon for the United States by 2012. In his own words, the Greek engaged in a variety of creative accounting practices, and there were a lot of big and bad surprises that caused this situation to arise. The U.S. has also been engaged in a lot of creative accounting for years with regards to the Social Security trust funds. And now we've got major creative accounting going on with government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We own a super majority of them, but we're not consolidating them into the financial statements. We don't consolidate the Federal Reserve into the financial statements either. And the bottom line is, we're not Greece. But we could end with the same problems down the road if we don't get spending under control and start dealing with our structure deficit soon. How soon? Walker points to 212. My view, he said, is that it could look at if you look at total debt to gross gross product, we're already over 70-85%. We're going to be at 100% within 2 years. So in other words, gross domestic product. We're 85% of that is debt. You hear that?
Yeah.
So our gross domestic product is like $3 or $4 trillion or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or more. I don't know. So it's high. Could be even more than that. But we're at 85% of that in our debt.
Wow.
So we owe more than we produce, and when that happens,
so you can't ever pay it off.
Never pay it off.
So it's like having a credit card that just
keeps going. And
yeah.
Going.
Maybe you can pay the interest, but I don't even know if we can do that anymore.
What's even more troubling is that we have to go to foreign lenders to finance our debt. 50% of our public debt are held by foreign lenders, and the Fed has been buying our debt at record rates to hold down interest rates. My father, J. Irving Weiss, founder of the Sound Dollar Committee, had probably the greatest impact of all on the public awareness of these dangers. The big difference, that was a half century ago. In 1959, he launched a national grassroots campaign that prompted an estimated 11 million Americans to demand an end to federal deficits. And he helped President Eisenhower pass the last truly balanced budget without creative accounting in our nation's history. Unfortunately, however, despite valiant attempts to repeat that success, no national movement of this magnitude or impact has emerged since. And New York Times and Wall Street Journal adds that launched our Sound Dollar Committee campaign in 59, Dad warned about the future dangers. Inflation is a narcotic. It soothes and exhilarates while doing its deadly work. And he says, already it has reduced our dollar to half of its purchasing power. It is the killer rampant in our midst, threatening to destroy us as it has other countries whose rulers thought they could have a little bit of control spending and inflation, a little cheapening of their money. Then it was too late. Deficit spending and inflation are the twin poisons which are undermining your future. Some people say we need deficit spending by our governments for prosperity and growth, but they forget that the means can destroy the ends. But back in those days, like today, inflation was not perceived to be an imminent threat, but those who ignored it later lived to regret their complacency. And like today, Dad was certainly not the only one raising his voice in protest. Also widely quoted in the Sound Dollar Committee campaigns were his associate supporters and other contemporaries. And they all said the same thing. So, we got to hold on to our debt. I mean, we're going crazy debt-wise. And he's saying, but But, I mean, it may very well be the end of the economic world as we know it in 2012.
No, that could be.
Because it doesn't look like Obama boy that has any
nobody has a grip on it.
Has a grip on it or any desire to control it. So, you know, he talks at
the beginning. Well, he was put in there by the bankers, so he's not going to do anything.
Why? We just indebted forever to the banks. It doesn't change anything. We still are indebted to the banks, to the Federal Reserve. That's why we should abolish it, take our money back.
Yep.
I mean, they're a bunch of fucking crooks. Who needs them?
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Who needs them? So, anyway, from that, we're going to go to, we got about a 30-minute interview with Larry Dorman from the Ask Me Union, and we're going to talk about the Obama health care bill that just passed.
Okay.
Okay, and we'll be right there.
And our guest is Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for Ask Me Union. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Hey, it's great to be on.
It's great to have you on. It's a momentous day, isn't it?
Boy, this is perfect timing. Perfect timing.
I was getting worried that we weren't going to have anything.
Well, it looks like we finally have something.
Yeah, well, what do we have?
Yeah,
what is it that we actually have?
That's what people seem to be confused about. People are either happy that the bill is passed or angry that it's passed, but in general, people aren't sure why they're happy or angry.
I think you have to sort of just step back and say that this has been probably 6 years in the making. It took quite a bit of struggle to get there. Given the baseline motivation, which was to make sure that the uninsured had coverage and that affordable, accessible health care was out there for everyone, I think that this is a moment to... I think it is a moment for celebration to really do. There are a lot of good pieces to this bill, even though our union certainly had some concerns about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, on balance, this is a very good piece of legislation. And the fact
that there's still no public option on this thing, is there?
Well, you're right. There is no public option. There is no employer mandate, you know, the pay or play.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of positive pieces were stripped out of it. I'm certainly not going to deny that. But there are some good things. As I've been reading more and more about it, it prohibits pre-existing exclusions for children. It provides immediate access.
How about adults?
That's why I said children.
Are you serious?
That was pretty well known, Leo.
I didn't know it.
But it does. When you ask about what's in it for adults, it does prohibit dropping people from coverage when they get sick in their individual plans. It gets rid of the donut hole that has hurt seniors on Medicare.
Is that prescription drugs? Is that what that donut hole is?
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the Bush and the Republican Congress who put that through as a gift to the pharmaceutical companies, and it's really a painful thing, as you know, for a lot of senior citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Are we still...
It lets kids lets children... stay on their parents' plan until age 26.
That's a good thing.
So there are a lot of good, pieces, and I think that on balance, again, it's a strong piece of legislation. And when you consider that we've had nothing really in the way of health care reform, and you had such nasty opposition and this kind of smear campaign and distortion. I think that people have to step back and say this is an incredibly positive achievement. And could it be better? Yes. Do we have concerns about it? Yes. But on balance, again, it's a good piece of legislation.
But my question here now is this: this was passed by there was two bills, right? It was passed by the House bill and the Senate bill.
Right, there were actually two House bills.
But then they passed both bills today,
right. And sent the second one to the Senate, which is the one that President Obama signed. It was kind of a procedural thing, but basically yesterday, or I should say Sunday night, the House. House took two votes, and they voted, I believe, and again, they were pretty much fairly, very similar bill. So they sent it, and so I believe the margin was 220 to 211. I mean, there were some Democrats who voted for the bill, obviously, and then that was sent to the Senate and on to the president, and, you know, the Senate was a simple majority vote. They couldn't filibuster to stop it. So that's how we ended up in very rapid fashion. So when you think about all the wrangling and argumentation and the Tea Parties and everything else, I think it's really quite an achievement to be sitting here talking about
it. But I still don't know what we have. That's the thing. And we're talking about it, but I don't understand what we really have.
Right.
I mean, do you fully understand?
I fully understand it? Of course not.
Do we still have abortion or non-abortion? Do we still have
You can't get an abortion under this, but you could get health insurance for yourself that would cover that. Is that my understanding, Larry?
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, one help, if I could. I mean,
yeah.
one site that I look at fairly frequently is the Healthcare for America Now Coalition's website, and it's called Healthcare for America Now, and that really has a pretty good explanation. There are a number of sites that do try to explain it, but I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know the nuances of this bill. I don't, because there's an incredible number of details in our
I think what got everybody so mad on this bill was all the giveaways that it gave the Louisiana Purchase, they call it, and South Dakota got Medicare.
Did they wipe those out?
And all this. Did that get compromised again, or did that get taken out, or what?
They say that again? Now, which part?
The payoffs that they made to the different senators there.
The pork, yeah. So-called.
I
don't know the extent to which. I think a lot of that was stripped out.
Was it? Because I know they gave South Dakota, I think it was, they gave them, paid for their entire Medicaid, all right, payments, and then they paid for, then they gave, who was it? There was another one that they gave a huge thing to as well. I did know all of them, but I've kind of forgotten.
I don't remember either now.
Four different state senators that they gave these big.
But I think those were stripped out when they went back to the drawing board. That was my understanding.
Probably.
I can't say for sure.
You know, Larry.
But again, I think you step back and say, look at where we've been, and look at how bitter and distorted the campaign was, the campaign against this legislation. We all agree that it's not perfect. There are many components we don't like. Again, we had concerns about the excise tax.
Right.
Fortunately, it doesn't get phased in until 2018. And many of the higher-end plans would be exempt under this new bill. So it's a start, and I think you just need people need to step back and look at the fact that we couldn't have had this under the Bush administration, and we're in better shape. The country is in better shape because this debate started and because the president signed this bill into law. There's an undeniable, inextricable connection between the state of health care and the American economy.
That's for sure.
I think it certainly sends a message that the next step is looking at how to stimulate more employment, get money flowing. But having expanding health care security is a great thing.
It is to the extent that we can that it really is a benefit. But from what I can see, there's no benefit in this health care. I mean, to adults, they're still denied insurance coverage because of pre-existing conditions. All right, isn't that true?
Well, again, you know,
and
stepping back and I'm looking at the components as I understand them, and it's hard for me to be. It's hard for me to be critical or negative of a bill that provides immediate access to insurance for the uninsured. I mean, we have to remember that that was the baseline, one of the baseline goals. To answer your question again, our understanding, my knowledge of this, it provides immediate access to insurance, for the uninsured, who in fact are uninsured because of a pre-existing condition. There's going to be a temporary high-risk pool that will be set up, so that is designed to address the pre-existing problem.
But yet, the insurance companies have already raised their rates by 30% and more this year.
And Leo, you need to step back and say, how is the system working now? It's working terribly.
It's broken now. Let's face it.
But they've already accepted that increase, okay, and have done nothing to curb their power. They still haven't stripped them from the antitrust law.
Both know me well enough. I'm advocate for the end of the private insurance industry. They're greed mongers of the worst sort. But this bill, which they opposed lock, stock, and barrel, they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to fight in and defeat. They weren't able to do that. And when you step back and say, here's a plan that says people who have been denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions will be able to get health care through a high-risk pool, temporary high-risk pool, that's a good thing. When you're going to have more children covered, that's a good thing. When you're going to have small businesses being able to use tax credits to purchase coverage, that's a good thing. When you prohibit dropping people from coverage when they get sick in any individual plan, that's a good thing, and so on and so forth. So is it perfect? Not by any stretch of the imagination. We've had enough discussions on what's flawed about this thing, but to be here today talking about having something in place, I think is pretty historic. Now, obviously it's going to take a while to see how this unfolds and if, in fact, it provides affordable, accessible coverage, if it provides employers with more incentives, if it enables them to focus on hiring people and creating jobs rather than paying incredibly exorbitant premiums.
Supposed to go into effect until 2014 or something. That's the crazy part about it.
We're living in England or Canada or Sweden. Obviously, we're not even having this discussion. By the fate of all of our births, we're here. We're trying, all of us, you guys, who are doing such a great job with your radio show. We're all trying to change this country in some fundamental way so that things are fairer. And, we know that we don't have all the power. We don't have the money. And that's why I really do try to take a big picture view of this thing and say, for all the flaws, all the problems, getting this thing through Congress was quite an achievement, an impressive achievement. And look, if it needs fixing, then we're going to have to fix it. Our only alternative, for those of us who want to see real universal health care and a single-payer system, is to, quite frankly, is to move out of the country. And I'm not, I know you guys aren't doing that. You have to agitate for change.
Well, we didn't get exactly what we wanted, which my choice was single-payer, as a lot of other people.
I mean, you guys know where I've been on this, and I know where you have been on this.
Yep.
So we're all sitting here going, boy, it could have been so much better.
With all the opposition, I'm really surprised that we got anything, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I think the outcry you're seeing from the Tea Parties, the Tea Partiers, the Tea Baggers, and the Republicans who have really been an obstructionist party, tells you that something good happened.
Well, we got 13. Was it 13 attorneys? I just read the article on the air. 13 attorney generals sue the federal government over the health care overhaul and saying that it's unconstitutional.
Well, that's the most ridiculous.
But there are Republican attorney generals who seem to be all running for governor.
Yeah, they're all kind of.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Labeled, which is, again, it's disappointing because we do need more of a bipartisan approach in this country, but perhaps having a bipartisan approach, we wouldn't have had anything because the Republicans clearly aren't interested in doing anything.
That's right. They're the party of opposition.
What they did when they had the power was to jam through the Bush tax cuts for the rich, jam through a war that we can't get ourselves out of. So I
two wars.
This is something that actually might help people.
Well, I'm hoping it's going to help individuals, but I'm also hoping it's going to help small business, because I think small business is really the heart of what goes on in this country, and they employ a lot of people.
Right.
And any kind of support we can give them, I think, is wonderful.
And then I think ultimately what we've got to have is this health care reform needs to work for business,
Absolutely.
And one thing during our own campaign for the Sustenet legislation in Connecticut, which is sort of, mini health care reform or state style health care reform, we ran into a lot of small businessmen who wanted to see the Sustenet bill passed and who wanted health care because they are decent employers. They don't want to go without, and it's just too expensive. Insurance companies just treat them with complete disregard and disdain. So that's we're going to have to be measured about this and see how it really works and takes off. But I think when you look at the outcry from the opposition, that something good must have happened.
And apparently the Senate is going to put forth some modifications. Do you have any idea what those are?
No, I don't. I wish I did, but I'm trying to understand the basics right now.
And I think this bill will obviously be tweaked as time goes on.
Right.
And do you have any idea, what percentage of people won't be covered by this?
My understanding, no, I don't have an exact percentage, but given that you have up to, I think, you have over 40 million uninsured, I believe that this will not take, if it were to be implemented immediately, which it won't be, it is not going to affect all or provide coverage for all 40 million, but I believe the target number that it hits is around 24 million.
Okay.
Are the reasons people wouldn't
be covered?
Yeah, I'm curious. What makes
people?
I don't know who falls out of those. There are cracks that big cracks that people fell through, and I don't know.
And then you hear these horror stories.
I don't know what accounts for, and I apologize. I don't know what accounts for the difference in the total number of uninsured and those who would benefit from this act. Obviously, not everybody is benefiting.
Would those be I just wondered if it would be people who decide not to purchase insurance, even though they're penalized, they decide not to. So it would be those people, right?
Right, I'm assuming. And again, they're just, we have to, we're going to have to fix flaws. Something that people need to retreat from because there's a lot of changes that are going to have to be made.
And I happen to believe that health care is something that people should have, like food and shelter and access to education. I mean, I believe those are fundamental things in a civilized society.
Right. And, look, I also don't want to lose sight of the fact that I think what I'm saying is that the bill, in our view, in AFSCME's view, the AFL-CIO, the labor movement sees it as a foundation, and it's a fairly solid foundation. But what that implies is there needs to be more. And one of them, when you ask me what that more is, we need to do more to bring down costs. That's the public health insurance option.
Right.
We've got to make sure that we build on the reforms and that we keep moving. But, I think we're going to have to see how this thing plays out. But it really does, on the face of it, provide long-term health security for millions of Americans. And I think that's, again, I think that's all to the good.
I do, too.
And my understanding, again, Leo and Lila, it bans coverage denials for higher rates due to those pre-existing conditions. It outlaws the practice of insurers dropping coverage when you file a claim or you're diagnosed with a condition that requires expensive treatment.
Mm-hmm.
actually I'm going through my notes, and what I find is that I misspoke that according to AFL-CIO research, that the bill covers an additional 32 million people, and that's about 95% of the uninsured population. Now, I don't know why 5% aren't covered, and that's just a tough one to figure out, but we've made a positive start.
Well, that's good. That means that most people will have access to insurance and health coverage, and that's a very important thing, and
When does it actually start, though? It doesn't start till...
When does it take effect?
2014 or something?
I believe it is. I think it kicks into gear... Well, it kicks into gear sooner than that, or components of it, because...
it's kind of in stages, isn't it, that things
Medicare
are done?
Stuff moves, I believe, in 2011. Part of what the bill does, it cuts the brand name drug prices for Medicare beneficiaries, and that's supposed to happen in 2011.
Oh, good.
And it will close that, the Medicare prescription drug donut hole completely, I believe, by 2020. Is it going to affect tomorrow? No.
It's done gradually.
I would just say it gets phased in. 2013, 2014, and onward. And you can understand.
Sorry, folks. I just got to turn that over. And not decrease or negotiate prices by pharmaceuticals under this plan. All right.
Originally.
And he guaranteed them $70 billion in profits, over the next number of years.
And so the pharmaceutical companies have been, curiously quiet during this debate as opposed to the insurance companies. So I think you can sort of infer from that maybe this isn't the worst thing they've ever seen.
Right, and they're Obama, Obama made a deal with them. He made the big deal with them right before, even before all this started. He wanted to. He was not going to negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical.
And that's another flaw. That's
a joke.
Canadian drugs.
We're paying 400 times more.
Right.
Than all the other countries for our medicines.
After we've supposedly developed most of them, with our good people, with our brain power.
Much of what has been developed actually was developed by taxpayer money in universities and so on and so forth. And then these patents were given by the government to, these pharmaceutical companies. Imagine that. All right. And they've been making money off the taxpayer since day one. All right. And their R&D costs are bull. Because 9 out of 10 of the great advancements are made by on the taxpayer dollar.
Right.
All right. And then they're bought out by, or they're not even bought by, given in many cases to these pharmaceutical companies who are going to manufacture.
Well, they have done some of their own research.
Yeah, I know, but the R&D, this whole thing cracks me up because this R&D. The cost that they're talking about, the 7 years of this and that. That's bull because a lot, much of the breakthrough medicine is coming from our universities and hospitals and so on and so forth,
Right.
And research institutes, not these damn pharmaceutical companies. All they are vultures, they're ready there to pick the bones.
We hope that going down the line that people can get tough on that. Well, you have to get your foot in the door. Yeah, and that was the most difficult thing, I think.
I think that's well said. I think that's very well said because, again, this is a bill that does, in part, hold the health insurers more accountable, makes it more difficult for them to dodge their responsibilities to those they cover. Potentially it means, I think millions of families will be protected from really horrible financial consequences when the family experiences an unexpected illness or requires ongoing chronic care. So that's what I meant when I said there's the issue of economic security is so inextricably tied to having health care reform. I thought it was sort of this false dichotomy that the Republicans were using when in criticizing Obama, that the focus needed to be on jobs. I don't think the Democratic leadership has ever shifted their focus away from jobs, but I think the president and the Democratic leadership realize that economic security and health care reform are just tied together. And so we've made a start. Again, it's a solid foundation.
Yeah.
It doesn't have everything we want. No, again, I'm not going to sit here and, you know, to sit here and say otherwise would be dishonest.
But with all the money that was fighting against it, I mean,
that's kind of where I'm coming from. And I think that we'll just have to see how it
plays out down the road. I'm hoping that there will be more changes, more positive changes as time goes on. But you can't change anything unless you have a bill.
Right. Exactly. That's what we have to build on. And, I think the three of us agree we'd rather be in a country like, or we'd rather have a system like Canada's or England's, or France's, tailored to our American way of life. And certainly that was a sad part of the debate to see that piece of it kind of go down. But we have emerged with something. We can build on it, and we'll make it better. And we're certainly not done in the labor room, but trying to make it better. I'll say that much.
I wanted to change the subject a little, and I wanted to ask you about layoffs in general. Are we seeing any more major layoffs or any major industries failing right now?
In Connecticut
or around the country? Have we stopped the bleeding for a while, or is it?
We've stopped the bleeding. We have a governor that has been asleep at the switch for her since this economic crisis really took root. If you look at the Connecticut Department of Labor figures, actually in January was the highest. Unemployment was at its highest in January of 10, compared to January of the previous year and then compared to the previous months.
Wow.
So we're not out of the water. And it was interesting and distressing to see UTC complaining about the unfair business climate, which was ironic since they're trying to move jobs out of Connecticut, trying to make the economy worse, not better. And what offended them actually were some proposals that state Democrats at the legislature put forward to change the tax reporting system so that more of their income is reported, as Connecticut income, essentially.
Gotcha.
The unified tax reporting bill, because they create so many shelters in lower cost states and out of the country as well, Bermuda and places like that. So,
but I'm sick and tired of United Technologies and these big defense companies, getting it from both sides. In other words, eating with both hands, is basically what they're doing. They're getting it from the towns, and then they're getting it from the taxpayers, because these guys are building these defense contracts. These guys are having all these defense contracts, building all the boats, building all the guns, building all the helicopters, building all the stuff that is going over to foreign countries to blow them up. All right? I mean, it's just an absurd.
I mean, to laugh, but you're right.
That's what we're dealing with here. We're keeping. Without us, without the U.S. taxpayer, companies like UTC wouldn't even be in existence.
Exactly. And it's funny when you look at some of the things that do make it difficult for companies in Connecticut. One of them, we have one of the highest, if not the highest, utility rates.
Second to Hawaii.
As a fault of a legislature that under Governor Rowland rolled over for the utility industry and deregulated it so they could make more money. All the things that companies love to complain about, they had a hand in creating, because it then helps them go complain about.
Well, now you got the damn water companies that want to bilk us for another 30% or some crazy number. I'll tell you, I've had my dealings with the DPUC in the state, and they are a bunch of rat
difficult to deal with that group.
Real jerks from jerk water, man. I'll tell you, these guys have no integrity.
Well, they're all appointed.
None.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, Lila. That's the point.
And I don't like that.
They're all rolling appointees.
These are rolling appointees.
They're rats. You know, they're schmucks.
They're consumer. They're pro-big business. They're anti-consumer.
Yeah, they're pro-nuclear. They're pro-consumer.
Pro-business.
You know.
Even if the business originates from out of state, it doesn't matter to them.
They're rats. I mean, they're sewer dwellers, you know. I mean, as far as the commission goes, I've seen too much of this stuff that they've done. I mean, they're just... I don't even know why they're in existence other than to be lapdogs to the industry, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, again, these are the companies that get the best and biggest tax breaks, and they get special considerations, just as the wealthy. I'm not against success. I just think that you got to, if we're going to get on solid footing, you have to talk about making the rich pay their fair share. You really do.
That's right.
Essentially, you and I are paying the same upper tier tax rate as the wealthy pay. You know, that's not right.
Hey, you think we
got companies that are paying bare minimum in corporate taxes, that's not right. This is why we can't fix our schools and our roads. This is why we don't have enough police in our communities. This is why we can't fix the healthcare system in Connecticut. This is why we don't have job training programs. And this is why the unemployment system breaks down at the time.
Hey, have we got any decent person running for governor this time?
Well, interesting. We just hosted a debate on Saturday in West Hartford. The Democratic candidates all came. Only one Republican came, and I give him a lot of credit. His name is Tom Marsh. He's the first selectman in Chester.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he's disappointed that his colleagues, such as Mike Fedeli, the lieutenant governor, Tom Foley, the wealthy businessman from Greenwich, he was disappointed they didn't show up. He felt that, you know, they owed labor union members and working families an explanation as to why they didn't show up. He said things that many in the audience disagreed with, but it was very civil. And it was actually, I enjoyed that the most because we really are trying to give our members the opportunity to make an informed decision, and it's sad to see candidates just reflexively dismissing a chance to talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
Really, because Mike Fedeli, who's the lieutenant governor of Connecticut, didn't even respond to our invitation.
Well, that's insulting.
Well, I can understand that in some way.
But I think you should respond. I mean, that's just good manners.
Well, you should respond, but what I'm saying,
thank you for saying that. It really offends me, but of the people who showed up, you know, it was very spirited. We broke out into small groups, and you know, clearly Dan Malloy, I think, is impressive. And, you know, has his Ned Lamont, has his Juan Figueroa. Mary Glassman's the first selectman of Simsbury. She.
Hey, what do you think of that guy that's running against Blumenthal?
Mary Galbert.
Yeah.
Interesting. Did you watch the debate?
I watched the debate.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he beat Blumenthal up pretty well.
I think he's going to be
he's a formidable opponent.
You know, it's the democracy generally works better when you have some chirping going on, some battling, and, you know, he's a battler. Is he going to defeat Dick Blumenthal in a primary? Absolutely not. But
who's to say not?
Is the system?
Who's to say not? Why do you think Blumenthal's a shoo-in?
That happening? You're right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add something really quickly. Yeah, I know that the state court is saying that there's a need for quantifying education quality, and they open the door to significant changes in the way the state funds public education. Well, how do you feel about that? I think that's a good thing.
If the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court,
yeah, that they've opened the door to significant changes in the way.
Yeah, I think it's a very important ruling, and I think it's a positive one.
I do too.
That hopefully kind of shifts the debate to making sure we're funding things in a fair fashion, that education is focused on getting kids jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically what they've said is, and I know this sounds kind of trite, I guess, but it needed to be handled legally. The Supreme Court has essentially said children have the right to a quality education. And I know that sounds kind of, well, of course, didn't and we always believe that.
But the way the tax structure is, that doesn't happen.
With the need for, I guess, you know, for modern educational standards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very positive decision, because what had happened was the state was trying to fight it. And, you know, what it does is it holds the state accountable for providing all students with a constitutionally adequate education. And, you know, it should be proved to be a very empowering development. So, you know, I just think that the coalition, there's a group that really was pushing this. It's called the Connecticut Coalition. If I have it right, it's the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Education Funding.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, they filed a lawsuit against the Rail Administration, arguing that Connecticut has failed to equitably and adequately fund public schools, and that cuts to the, you know, the property tax system,
right.
The fact that the state has retreated from its education cost sharing requirements. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a very significant ruling.
And I think this is an excellent ruling.
Just the children, our kids have a right to, and you work in a school system, so you understand this law.
Yeah.
It's that you know, the state can't retreat on its right to fairly fund and help implement a system of education that provides kids with real learning and real opportunity to be employed at the end of that education. And the state, particularly under Roland Rail, has just done a horrible job of, you know, participating in education cost sharing and in funding the improvements that are needed. So I think there's a lot of significance to this.
I do, too, and I think that's good for all Connecticut citizens.
Exactly.
Educated,
no, exactly.
Employable people are the key to our future.
Some of the other devices and suits that are also legitimate and also of deep concern, but in the end, you know, getting rid of funding and programmatic inequities is the best thing we can do for all our kids, regardless of what town or city they live in.
And you know what, Larry? I can't believe it. Our discussion, time has come to an end. We had a great discussion, and thanks for helping us understand.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate having you on, Larry, and thanks for being with us.
All right.
Okay.
Hey, keep me posted on the book.
Yeah, it's out. You can get it at Amazon.com.
I will buy it, okay?
All right. Thank you much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
That was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for the Aspen Union, trying to help us understand the health care legislation. Hopefully it will be shaped and amended to create the kind of health care legislation I want.
There you go.
But,
and we're going to be bringing up Woody in just a second. And that was Larry Dorman. This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millerton. You're listening to the L.A. Steel Show. And don't forget to buy a copy of Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And that's available right now up on Amazon. .com.
Okay, Leo's going to call, dial up Woody for In the Ring. Going to do it right now. He's getting his introduction music on.
All right. So, I hope you enjoyed that.
That was Larry Dorman with the Aspen Union. And I had a good time with him. So I hope you'll enjoy. Tomorrow night we'll be back. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to be doing, but we will be back tomorrow, speaking from on more of a spiritual level. Be reading something good. So join us tomorrow, and thanks for joining us tonight.